And good evening, and thank you for coming back for our last session this weekend on preparing the mind to meet Jesus. And this evening, we're going to be talking about the disorders of depression and anxiety. And this is what we're going to do tonight, look at some of the issues in your own brain, in your own physical body, to see if you can't understand more fully God's creation and His design for us, to apply God's methods and principles to bring healing to our minds, to comprehend the connection between the physical and the spiritual issues going on in our person. Depression, anxiety, the physical. Okay, what we're going to do is our overview. We're going to go into depression. What is it? The historical overview of depression. Prevalence and cost of depression, symptoms, diagnosis, and course, how depression affects the brain and body, contributing factors to depression, and then treatment options and strategies. Most of that time is going to be spent on the contributing factors to depression and a good bit on the how it affects your brain and body. So depression, what is it? What is depression? Everybody in some time in their life has experienced a depressed mood, a sad mood, a down mood. This is not what we talk about when we talk about depression. Depression actually is a disorder of altered brain function. When people are depressed, their glucose metabolism of the brain is altered, meaning the cellular function, they are not active in the same level. Glucose is the energy source that the brain cells use, and since they're not using as much glucose, they're not as active. Altered brain blood flow in the brain. Blood flow is reduced when people are depressed. Altered electrical activity in the brain when depression occurs. Altered protein production. The actual synthesis of proteins in the brain is altered during depression. Altered neurotransmission. The signaling from neuron to neuron is altered in depression. Altered neurogenesis. That's a big word that means the production of new brain cells. And I'm going to explain that when we get a little more into the physiology. But neurogenesis is shut down or altered during depression. So depression is a global disorder in brain function. The brain is not functioning in its normal way when people have a major depression, or some people call a clinical depression. Historic overview, 4000 BC, Adam and Eve sinned, and they ran and hid because they were afraid. The first mood symptom that we have in our species happened when Adam and Eve sinned. And we talked about that earlier today when they believe those lies about God, resulting in that fear, that emotion of fear that comes up. And you're going to find that the emotion of fear is the source root in many of the symptoms and causes that lead to depression. You're also going to find that fear is a source root in most of the actions or behaviors that we engage in that we would call sins. If you think about the sins that we engage in, fear is at the root of much of it. Fear of not getting ahead, so we cheat at school to get a better grade. Fear of not getting, being able to pay our bills, so we cheat on our taxes. Fear of not being loved, so we lie about who we are when we're dating. Fear, and you see the point on down the line. Fear is at the root of much of this. First mood symptom was fear. The Ebers Papyrus in 1550 BC described depression, and the Ebers Papyrus attributed depression to demons, and it was the prescription of treatment was incantations to get rid of the demons. In 1000 BC, King David described depression, and he attributed depression to God, stress, and guilt, and the treatment that he described or prescribed was divine deliverance. And you can find that in Psalms 6 and Psalms 38. Galen in AD 150 described depression and contributed it to black bile or evil humors. And the treatment that Galen prescribed was bleeding, leeching, and blistering. And this went on, unfortunately, for more than 1,000 years, in which patients were depressed. They would actually be bled or had leeches put on them, or they would have some type of glass or something put on the skin, and the outside was lit by a flame, and it would cause a blister to come up on the skin to try to get out the evil humors that were thought to be attributing to the depression. In the 19th to the 20th century, the late 19th, early 20th century, Sigmund Freud described depression and attributed it to internal conflicts within your psychological makeup, that you had conflicts with yourself, and the treatment was psychoanalysis. In the 1950s, people discovered medications that had effect on the brain. The medication that discovered that about depression was actually an antihypertensive medication, a medication to treat high blood pressure that was called reserpine. And the way reserpine worked is it depleted from the neurons and the cells of the body some chemicals called dopamine and norepinephrine, and 70-80% of the patients who went on reserpine ended up with depression. This got people thinking, hey, this is a chemical problem that causes depression, and that led to the whole chemical theory, imbalance theory that you hear. We got a chemical imbalance, and therefore we treat chemical imbalances with other chemicals, and so we have the medication treatments. In the 21st century, where we are today, it is a depression is thought to be a complex interaction of biological, psychological, spiritual, and social factors resulting in altered brain function, and the treatment is targeted to the various stress or problem that is contributing to depression in the first place. Prevalence and cost, and this we really won't go into too much of the cost, but more along the prevalence. 10 to 25% lifetime risk for women. Basically, 1 in 4 women at some time in their life will have a depression. Men, it's 5 to 12% lifetime risk for men. About 1 in 8 men will have depression sometime in their life. So there's some biologic reasons for that. In the brain, there's a part of the brain that I'll describe to you in a little while called the limbic system, and I'll give you a picture of that. This is the brain that modulates mood. This part of the brain that modulates mood. And in that part of the brain, women have 50% less receptors that respond to a brain chemical called serotonin, if you've heard of serotonin. Women have 50% less there than men do. And not only that, the serotonin receptors are modulated by estrogen. And so during a monthly cycle, the estrogen levels fluctuate and can cause the serotonin receptors they have to not work as well. And so they're much more prone to mood variations than men are who don't have those estrogen variabilities. And have 50% more serotonin receptors. That's just one factor amongst many that contribute to increasing depression in women. 15% of people who have major depression die by suicide. This is not attempt suicide. They actually die by suicide, complete suicide. Think about a disease state that 15% of people die from. Well, 15% of people with depression die by suicide. And 70% of all suicides of the people who commit suicide, actually 70% of them have depression. So it makes up the vast majority of the ones who have who commit suicide. Symptoms, diagnosis, and course. The symptoms of depression that have to persist straight for at least 2 weeks or more and have to impair function include alterations in addition to depressed mood, include alterations in ability to enjoy activities, loss of desire or drive or initiative, loss of sleep or sleeping too much, guilt feelings, feelings of worthlessness, no energy, impaired concentration, changes in appetite, increased, decreased physical movement, and suicidal thoughts. You have to have 5 of these persisting for 2 weeks or more and have impaired function, and you meet the criteria for having depression. Now, you notice the symptoms here cover the whole gamut of human experience. And the reason for that is I've already described to you earlier that when somebody has depression, they have altered brain function. Well, if the brain is altered, then you're going to have symptoms that correspond to the functions of the brain. So we get altered sleep, we get altered appetite, we get altered energy, we get altered motivation, we get altered libido, we get altered concentration, we get altered thought processing. Why? Because the brain is altered in its function, so the whole gamut of our experience is altered when somebody is depressed. Recurrence rates. If somebody has one episode of depression only in their life, you treat that depression, say, with a medication, and the depression goes away, and they are completely back to normal, which is called remission, and you keep them on the treatment for an entire year, and then you take the medication away, the likelihood of a recurrence or going back into depression is 10 to 15%. If somebody has 2 episodes of depression, you treat them with a medication until they go into remission, and you keep them on the medication for an entire year in remission, no symptoms, and you take them off the medication, the likelihood of recurrence is 70%. If somebody has 3 episodes of depression or more, you treat them to remission so they're completely depression-free, keep them on medication for an entire year, take them off of medication, the likelihood of another episode of depression is 90%. So, and there's reasons for this you'll discover as we go through a little physiology what happens in the brain, but basically the brain changes with depression and makes us more vulnerable to have more depressions in the future. This is one of the reasons we want to treat it early, treat it quickly, and treat it to remission so we can maybe impact less long-term consequences on the brain. How does depression affect the brain and body? I've got a little diagram here of some various elements of the brain. The areas I want to focus on, this area right here is called the amygdala, and we're going to walk through, we'll give you an analogy, make this easy to learn, but these are the areas we're going to focus on, amygdala, hippocampus, this part of the brain up here is called the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of your brain right behind your forehead where you do your thinking and reasoning. That's where you have your creativity, your imagination, your ability to self-restrain, your ability to organize, prioritize. That's the part of the brain that really separates us from the animals. This is where we have our spiritual nature. This is where we have our conscience, our reason, and our ability to worship, all up here. This part of the brain right here, the anterior cingulate cortex, that is the part of the brain that houses your will. When you make powers of choice, that happens in this part of the brain here. This part of the brain down here, the limbic system, is where we get our emotions and our feelings. Now, I'm going to give you a little analogy. The amygdala, actually, is the part of the brain that is the alarm center of your brain. I want you to imagine, we'll use the analogy, and I don't see one here in this building, but many buildings and schools will have a little red button on the wall that we pull for a fire alarm. You've seen those? A little red box, you pull the thing, and it sets off a fire alarm. The amygdala is equivalent to that fire alarm. When the amygdala fires, it's like pulling the alarm on the wall. What happens when you pull the alarm on the wall? It sends a signal to the 911 operator, right? Pull the alarm, 911 operator has a buzzer go off on her desk or her screen telling her there's a fire over here. In our brain, when the amygdala fires, it alerts the 911 operator, which is your hypothalamus, which is connected to your pituitary gland. So your hypothalamus, pituitary gland axis, you've heard of your pituitary gland, that's your 911 operator. So alarm goes off, alert the 911 operator. What's the 911 operator do? She calls in emergency responders, right? Calls in the fire team, the police, or whoever the emergency responders are. That's her job. Well, that's the job of the hypothalamic pituitary axis. When it gets alerted, it calls in the emergency responders, which are your stress hormones, your glucocorticoids, and your adrenaline, your catecholamines. And so when it fires, it kicks up from the adrenal cortex, your adrenal glands, all the adrenaline and those types of things, which are your emergency responders. Once the emergency responders arrive to the scene of the emergency, there's usually a fire chief on the scene, and the fire chief assesses how many emergency responders we have. And when there's enough emergency responders, the fire chief calls back to the 911 operator and says, hey, even though that alarm is still blaring in that building, we've got plenty of emergency responders here. You don't need to send any more, right? That fire chief, in our little analogy, are the hippocampal neurons. The hippocampal neurons have within them glucocorticoid receptors. So as the emergency responder level, the glucocorticoid levels rise, they signal into the hippocampus, they register that rise, and when they get to a certain point, the hippocampal neurons send a feedback over to your 911 operator, your hypothalamus, telling your hypothalamus, hey, even though the amygdala is still firing, you can shut down the releasing factors. Don't send any more emergency responders. We've got plenty on the scene. This is how it's designed to work. Now, let me walk you through a little scenario of real life and how this works. You're walking out on a weekend with your family at the park, and as you're walking along casually, as you're about to step forward, your foot is about to hit, you see right down there in the grass something black and slithery by your foot. What's likely to happen? Alarm center, your fire alarm there, your amygdala is going to fire, right? And as soon as it does, it kicks up to your 911 operator, your hypothalamus, which is going to send out for some emergency responders, your glucocorticoids and adrenaline. That's going to fire up. And when that happens, your heart rate picks up, your blood pressure picks up, your respirations pick up, blood is shunted away from your skin and your gut into your muscles, your pupils dilate, and you're about ready to rock and roll. And about that moment, after all that's happened, your prefrontal cortex, where you do your thinking and reasoning, catches up and says, oh, it's just a rubber hose. Haven't you all had something like that happen in your life? You've had this terrible alarm go off, you're scared half to death, and then you're a few seconds later, your prefrontal cortex catches up and says false. And when that happens, the prefrontal cortex, realizing it's just a rubber hose, sends a signal through your anterior cingulate cortex, where is your will, you make that choice that says to the alarm, false alarm, you can turn off. And the alarm turns off, and everything starts to calm down. This is how the feedback loops were designed to work. What happens when something goes wrong? And here's what happens. If this amygdala never shuts off, if the alarm keeps blaring, even though you've got the glucocorticoid levels rising, and if the alarm never shuts off, then a negative cascade of events will happen. And what is it that prevents the alarm from shutting off? Unhealthy thought patterns. The people who worry excessively about everything, always worrying about what people think about me, always wondering if I'm not going to be good enough, always fearful about everything. The chronic worriers, people who have been in traumas, who have in their traumatic experience, like a war veteran. Imagine being in Iraq tonight and you're sleeping out, bivouac somewhere in Iraq tonight. Do you think you might allow yourself to fall totally into a deep sleep? Or might you have some part of your brain that keeps you kind of on alert even while you're dozing? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, that is your amygdala. Sometimes out of a post-traumatic situation, this amygdala gets upregulated and it's much more sensitive to being fired than it was normally. So the amygdala fires in the post-traumatic stress situation too much and too frequently. People who have unresolved guilt, I mentioned earlier, will continue to fire the amygdala. Resentment, bitterness, anger, negative thoughts of all kinds fire the amygdala, and the amygdala keeps firing. One other way it keeps firing, chronic pain states. Imagine right now as you're sitting here, something sharp grabs your leg. Do you think your alarm would fire? Do you think you'd go to a quick alert? Okay, because through the pain pathways of your spinal tract, it's called the spinal thalamic tracts, the pain pathways in your spine, your spinal cord, come up through the thalamus, which is a part of your brain, and go to the amygdala and alert the amygdala to fire it to bring you to attention to something dangerous is happening. If you have a chronic pain state, those pathways, not coming from where you do your thinking and reasoning, but coming out of the spinal column, will continue to fire your amygdala. So if you're in a situation, either from lots of negative and unhealthy thought patterns or from a chronic pain state, where the amygdala keeps firing and it doesn't turn off, then a cascade of negative events occurs. The amygdala will activate your sympathetic nervous system. That results in a certain white blood cell called a macrophage being activated. And that macrophage, or those macrophages in your body, will start releasing toxic little terrorists called cytokines. And I call them toxic little terrorists because what the cytokines will do in this situation is they go around in your body and they first start damaging insulin receptors in your body. They then kill your fire chief. They actually go up there and assassinate your fire chief up here. They kill the glucocorticoid receptors in your hippocampal neurons. As soon as that happens, the feedback loop is broken. The 911 operator no longer gets the signal to shut down, so the 911 operator keeps sending to the adrenal cortex release stress hormones. Stress hormones include glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids cause your liver and your body to release more glucose into your bloodstream. At the same time that the cytokines are killing your insulin receptors, and the insulin receptors react to glucose to take glucose down and bring the glucose levels down. So when this process happens like this, you have increasing risk of diabetes type 2, obesity, dyslipidemias, which are high bad cholesterol and triglycerides, increased risk of heart attacks, strokes, as well as bone density loss, all occurring because, potentially, of a negative thought processing pattern in the prefrontal cortex activating this amygdala and never shutting down. Physiologic changes throughout the body, all coming from the brain. Pretty fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. Now, David says in Psalm 6, 2 and 3, in verses 6 and 7, he says, "Be merciful to me, Lord, for I am faint. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in anguish. How long, O Lord, how long? I am worn out from groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes." Here's a depressed person. Interestingly, he mentions that his bones are in agony. This is from the Proverbs, Proverbs 14:30. "A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. A cheerful look brings joy to the heart, and good news gives health to the bones. And a cheerful heart does good like a medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones." Interestingly enough, this whole process that I just described to you has been documented to cause osteoporosis, weakness of the bones. The bones get weak when we have this negative cascade of constant glucocorticoid stress hormones going. The Bible told us this 3,000 years ago. Not only that, it says a cheerful heart doeth good like a medicine. If we have healthy thought processes in the from the prefrontal cortex, if we have healthy thought processes in the prefrontal cortex, it actually calms. There we are. Healthy thought process from the prefrontal cortex, it calms and turns off the amygdala, thus bringing health to the body. All those negative cascade of events that we just talked about with the increasing insulin, increasing glucose, increasing triglycerides, cholesterol, all those things don't happen when we have the amygdala getting turned off. So the Bible is right. A merry heart doeth good like a medicine. Now I'm going to take you, is everybody with me still? Okay. I'm going to take you one level deeper. gets even more fascinating. If that alarm doesn't turn off, so the toxic little terrorists do their thing, kill your fire chief, so the 911 operator keeps sending more glucocorticoids. As the glucocorticoid levels rise now, they do something bad. If all this wasn't bad enough, they do something bad. They cause a particular gene inside the neurons of your brain cells to turn off. This gene is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or produces a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Brain-derived means it comes from the brain. Neurotrophic means it causes the neurons to grow stronger. It's like fertilizer for the neurons, and it's the factor that does this. So it's like fertilizer for the neurons. When it's available, the neurons like it. They grow stronger. They'll branch out their dendritic tree to connect to other neurons. The networks can expand faster and easier. You can learn more. And under the influence of this protein, the brain will make new neurons under the influence of this protein. When this protein is not available, and I'll get into a little more details about that in a moment, but when it's not available, the brain stops making new neurons, and the neurons you have begin to wither and die, and you start losing neurons, particularly in the hippocampal regions. The hippocampal volumes begin to shrink, and this is what correlates with depression. This is why people get depressed. They're having this change going on in their brain. Now, when you treat people with a medication, say, and I'll tell you how the gene gets turned off. Everybody knows about DNA. You've heard about DNA, right? DNA is a double helix. It's like a zipper. In order for a protein to be produced, this is the code of life, so to speak, and every cell has the genes in the DNA. The DNA has to unzip like a zipper. Once it's unzipped, then a translation RNA can come in and read the code. The translation RNA then goes to a messenger RNA and sends the code through messenger RNA to transcription RNA, which goes to the ribosomes to produce the protein. Remember, this is biology 101 that we did in high school. Okay, so that's kind of what happens. But the key here is the DNA has to unzip. That's the key. What happens with these elevated cortisol levels is that they cause a methyl group to attach to a thing called a histone on the DNA. And basically, it's like getting a shirt tail caught in your zipper. Anybody ever got a shirt tail caught in their zipper? What happens when that happens? You can't unzip the zipper, okay? This methyl group gets caught in the DNA, and the DNA can no longer unzip. If the DNA cannot unzip, then the protein can't be produced. If the protein is not produced, cells begin to wither and die, okay? It's one of the factors going on. Now, when you give a medication, all the antidepressants work in this way. In fact, every treatment that has been effective so far in the treatment of major depression, whether it's ECT, shock treatment, whether it's magnetic stimulation, whether it's deep brain stimulation, whether it's vagal nerve stimulation, or whether it's medications, all the treatments effective for depression have, as a final common pathway, increasing the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor in the brain, and neural volume increases in the hippocampal regions as neurons are produced again in this part of the brain. The way the medications do that is they cause another chemical group called an acetyl group to attach next to that methyl group, and it basically pulls it out of the zipper, and it pulls it out of the zipper so the DNA can unzip again and this protein can be produced. So brain changes during depression. Impaired brain metabolism. The brain is not functioning at its normal level. Impaired neural signaling. The signaling is impaired. Impaired neurogenesis, we just talked about. The neurons are not being produced in the same way anymore. By the way, I'll just take a little aside and tell you, how many remember being taught somewhere in school that all the brain cells you have are all the brain cells will ever have, and when you lose them, they're gone, and the brain doesn't make new neurons? Anybody remember hearing that? Yes, I was taught that too, so we're all aging ourselves because we know that is in fact not true. The brain makes new neurons throughout life. My question to you is, what substrate does a brain use to make a new neuron? You see, most cells of the body, when we're producing new cells all the time, do something called cell division. One cell will split and divide into two cells. Cell division. Remember mitosis? Cell division. Okay? But a brain cell is connected up to 10,000 connections to other brain cells. Can that brain cell disengage 10,000 connections, split in two, re-engage those 10,000 connections while not losing its function? No, brain cells do not reproduce by cell division. Then where do new brain cells come from? This is so fascinating. Bone marrow stem cells under the influence of these proteins will differentiate into brain cells. The life is in the blood. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, what happens to someone who's had a bone marrow transplant? Has anybody heard of bone marrow transplants? When somebody has a disease that requires a bone marrow transplant, before they get the transplant, they have to irradiate and kill all of your bone marrow. And then after they kill all of your bone marrow, so you have none, then they implant the donor's bone marrow into that space, and it takes up residence there and lives in the bone marrow spaces, producing bone marrow that circulates to your body and all the blood and so forth and so on. So if you've had a bone marrow transplant, whose bone marrow stem cells are circulating in your body? Yours or the donor's? The donor's. Well, what do you think is going to happen in the brain? Well, interesting. They sure have done autopsies on people who've had bone marrow transplants, taken slices of the brain, looked at the brain cells, looking at the DNA in the brain cells of the people who've had bone marrow transplants. And so a woman who is XX chromosomal pattern, who has gotten a bone marrow transplant from a man who is XY chromosomal pattern, sure enough, in the brain, there are brain cells with XY chromosomes instead of XX. And vice versa. Meaning that, in fact, the brain cells are being produced from the stem cells of the bone marrow, and the donor stem cells are now setting up residence in the brain. What does that mean? Does that mean if the woman gets a bone marrow transplant from a man, she's going to love football? I don't know. Or that he's going to love to go shopping? I don't know. Nobody really knows the actual implications to what happens in the brain. We just know it actually is happening. I just find that fascinating. You know, aren't we marvelously and fascinatingly made? Yeah. Okay. Neuronal loss. We have neurons being lost in the brain when we're depressed. We have impaired electrical activity, impaired protein production, altered gene expression, impaired prefrontal cortex function. We can't think and reason as well. This is an MRI scan where they've taken and cut the slice or the image from left to right shoulder, right down the middle of the brain, looking back to front to back. And you'll notice this is the hippocampal areas of the brain. This is the normal. This is the patient with depression. They've highlighted it here for you and circled it in red so you can see. This is the normal size of hippocampus. There's the depressed person's hippocampus. Do you see the difference? Significant shrinkage, more than 50% smaller in the depressed person. And the hippocampal area, not only does it have this mood modulation we talked about, but the hippocampuses are the first gateway to all new memory and learning. If you remember anything from this weekend, it went through your hippocampuses first. If we do surgery and excise or cut out your hippocampuses, which have occurred because of traumatic brain injuries or because of serious brain tumors or because of serious seizure disorders, occasionally they've had to do that to people. And when they do, they can never learn anything new again. No new learning, because this is where all new learning starts. And when you learn something and you remember it for a short time, it's in your hippocampus. This is like your computer RAM in a certain way. And then as you go to sleep tonight, if you remember this next week, then during your sleep, what happens in sleep is that the information gets transferred out of the hippocampus to other brain areas for long-term retention and storage. This is a PET scan. PET scans are actually showing you active glucose metabolism. This is showing you the actual activity of the cells themselves. This is a brain of a normal person. The brighter those colors, the more active the brain is. If there's no bright colors, the brain is not active. Those cells aren't working. And this is the brain of a depressed person. And you can see how this brain is not really functioning or very active. When the patient has depression, we've got significant alteration in brain function. This is what somebody like that would look like. Classic picture of somebody with depression, and they're apathetic, they're listless, they're de-energized, they don't move, they don't have expression. If you ask them questions, there will be long pauses before they respond. They have very little information. They don't have the energy to search for information, so it's I don't know. These types of responses, because the brain is just not functioning like it should. So body changes during depression. Insulin resistance, increasing risk of diabetes mellitus, elevated cholesterol and triglycerides, increased pain. I didn't mention that, but yes, pain perceptions get worse. Increased risks of stroke, heart attack, alterations in heart electrical activity, so you have increased risk of arrhythmias and fatal arrhythmias. Alterations in platelet stickiness, so the platelets become more sticky and you can have increased risk of strokes and heart attack. Alteration in bone density, and alteration in immune system and cytokines all happen while we're depressed. The body suffers when we're depressed. Okay, contributing factors to depression. Adam and Eve sinned, what happened? We talked about this morning. We won't talk a lot about it right now. But broken love and trust, lies believed result in broken love and trust. Broken love and trust, fear and selfishness. Fear and selfishness, destructive acts. And destructive acts, damage to mind, character, and body. Two antagonistic principles we talked about, the love versus the survival of the fittest principle. The survival of the fittest principle is based on fear and selfishness. And when you act on that principle and act in selfish ways, it only increases the perception of fear. It flames up the amygdala. I want you to think about that. Think about any situation in which you act based on your selfish desires in a fearful way. So you're in a situation where you've been insecure and fearful, so you act out against somebody to exploit them, to take advantage of them. You lie, you cheat, you do something. Is that going to cause you to have more peace or more fear? You're going to begin worrying about getting caught, worrying about getting found out, worrying that somebody's going to retaliate against you. Your fears and anxieties go up when you react to that principle. It is only by acting in love, giving in beneficence, that we reduce the feelings of fear and insecurity and cause the feelings of fear and insecurity ultimately to go away as we love others more than ourselves. Physical and genetic defects entered the planet after sin occurred. Physical and genetic defects. This is something we really have to remember. And I have a lot of patients who come see me who are distraught as Christians that they struggle with depression and they worry that maybe that they have a faith problem. And I have to point out that we are 6,000 years from the hand of God. That I notice people in here wearing glasses. Adam and Eve did not need glasses. I know many people need braces. Adam and Eve did not need braces. I notice there's some people in here with gray hair. Adam and Eve did not have gray hair or wrinkles or any of this stuff. Okay, our physical bodies are way, way, way down the road from the way God made our physical bodies to work. Lots of gene defects have entered the gene pool, including the genes that govern the physiologic functioning of the brain. How much neurotransmitters your brain produces, gene-derived. How sensitive your brain receptors are. How many receptors your brain has. The reuptake pumps, how effective they are. All these things within the brain and the brain physiology is driven by gene expression. And these gene expression is not perfect as God made it to be. And so we're vulnerable to lots of mental illnesses, including depression. Only one power on earth can purge fear and selfishness from the heart. Let me give you a quick analogy. I want you to imagine that you are walking along the street and you're about to cross the street. And as you step out into the street, you look up and you see an 18-wheeler bearing down on you. What would your likely emotional response be? Fear. Now you're out walking along the street and you're with your 3-year-old son. And you get distracted by something going on over here. And as you look over here, your son steps out into the street and the 18-wheeler is bearing down on your son. You have just enough time to run out into the street and push him out of the way, but if you do, you will get hit by that 18-wheeler. What do? You push him out of the way, and as you run out there and push him out of the way, and you see him roll to safety on the grass, and that 18-wheeler is about to hit you now, what emotion are you experiencing? Relief, joy, happiness. In both situations, you're about to get hit by an 18-wheeler. In one, you have nothing but fear. In the other, you have joy. Why? Your love for your child purged the fear from your heart. The only power in the universe that can free us from fear is the power of love. Contributing factors to depression. And I break these into software defects. Think about a computer. A computer has hardware and a computer has software. If you have a computer that has good software but has bad hardware, it won't run right. If you have a computer with good hardware but bad software, it won't run right. You've got to have both good hardware and good software. The software in our brains are the things that we have learned. For instance, everyone in here, at least I think everyone here, has an English software package. Somewhere that software package got uploaded after birth. You were not born hardware wired for English. I know there are some people I've talked to that speak other languages besides English. Those languages were uploaded after birth. Your belief in God as you currently know Him was uploaded after birth. Your belief about male-female relationships and how those should work, uploaded after birth. Your belief about the morals and values you hold, uploaded after birth. All these things are part of this complex software system that is constantly being adapted and modified as we go through life. The hardware is the physical brain tissue structures and chemicals that we can actually lay our hands on and touch and measure. The hardware. And we have defects in both the software and the hardware that contribute to depression. General physical biological factors, these are the hardware defects that contribute to depression, our genetics we mentioned earlier. Gender, women have a higher risk of depression, and I mentioned some reasons for that. Age, adolescence, and the elderly have higher risk for depression. Adolescence, this is a great time of both physiologic as well as psychological change, but there's great hormonal changes going on at this time as well as psychological changes, makes them more vulnerable to depression. And the elderly have great physiologic changes happening throughout their body and their brains, making them more vulnerable to depression. History of previous depression is just another way of talking about your genetic vulnerability, and so is the family history. All those things. Specific biologic factors, medical illnesses. If you have cancer, if you have heart disease, AIDS, diabetes, terminal illnesses of any kind. The reason for this, I want you to remember this. Every organ system of your body has as its primary purpose to serve the brain. That's its purpose. The lungs breathe to give oxygen to the brain. The heart beats to give blood, glucose, and oxygen to the brain. The primary purpose of your organ systems are to keep your brain healthy. Your legs and arms are to get your brain around from place to place, to interact, for your brain to interact with the environment. That is the purpose of every organ system of your body. If your heart beats and your lungs breathe with no brain in the body, they do so without purpose. Their purpose. And thus, when we understand this, when the organs of the body are unhealthy, diseased, defective, then their ability to serve the brain is compromised and brain function is altered. Thus, the purpose of the health message is not for us to eat our way into heaven. You can't eat your way into heaven. The purpose, in fact, I remember the story about one couple that came into the church and read the writings on the health message and were convicted on the health message, and they wouldn't eat this and they wouldn't eat that, and they began to lose some weight, and at first they looked healthier, and then they continued on, they lost more weight, and they started to look unhealthy, and somebody said something to them about it, and I remember their words were, "Well, I'm going to keep this health message if it kills me." Wait a minute. That doesn't make much sense, does it? No, we can't eat our way into heaven. The purpose of the health message is to keep the physical body organs as healthy as possible so they can do their best in serving your brain to keep your brain as healthy as possible. If we have diseased body, diseased organs, we increase our risk of depression. Nutritional deficiencies, I'll mention some of those specifically, so I won't go into those now. On a little later slide, we'll go into some of the nutritional factors that contribute to depression. Limited physical activity. When you exercise physically, physical exercise causes the brain to produce brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor is a good thing. You want that in your brain. It's healthy, so when you exercise, it keeps the neurotrophic factors going. So limited physical activity would not be necessarily a good thing. It also keeps the organs of the body healthy, and so they can serve the brain and function the brain better. Alcohol and drug use are actually damaging to the organs of the body and to the brain, so they can contribute to dysfunction of the brain and contribute to depression. Pregnancy. Pregnancy. During pregnancy, we have significant hormonal changes occurring in the body. Additionally, you have this parasite in the body that is sucking away all of the nutrition and nutritional factors that the mother needs, which will increase the risk of depression. Pardon? Parasite. Well, that's what a pregnancy is. It's a parasite. It's an external living organism that is sucking nutrition away from the host, and it depletes the mother's nutritional resources and increases the risk for depression. It might be that you love this parasite, but that's what it's doing during pregnancy. Living in the Northern Hemisphere. In the Northern Hemisphere, we have alterations in light-dark wake cycles. It can alter our circadian rhythms. That can result in changes in certain brain hormones that can increase the risk of depression called seasonal affective disorder. This can be treated and remedied by using a 10,000 lux light and sitting in front of it for 15 to 30 minutes in the morning before the sun rises each morning, and it can remedy that situation. Infections of various kinds, HIV infection, tertiary syphilis, which is the third stage of syphilis, which is syphilis which infects the brain itself. Prions, which are like slow viruses, like mad cow's disease. so forth, that infect and bornea virus, things that infect the brain tissue, can contribute to depression. Toxins of all kinds, mercury, arsenic, lead, bismuth, industrial solvents and chemicals that we can come in contact and impact the hardware of the brain and alter the function of the brain, contributing to depression. Hormonal irregularities, hypothyroidism, low estrogens, low testosterones in men can all contribute to depression. Brain injury or damage, if you've had a traumatic injury, brain head injury can contribute to depression. Sleep disorders, I'll mention one. There's many sleep disorders. I'll mention one. Obstructive sleep apnea. Has anybody heard of obstructive sleep apnea? I'll describe to you what happens in this case. When you sleep at night and you have obstructive sleep apnea, the soft tissues in the back of the throat and mouth will relax as the muscles relax in your sleep. As the soft tissues relax, they cover over your windpipe, and you do something like this. You'll be asleep, and your diaphragm will try to expand and breathe, but the windpipe is closed, so you go, and there's no air moving. And if that happens, then the oxygen levels in the body begin to fall. As the oxygen levels fall, that in the brainstem itself, there's an alarm center there that goes on. It's a different one that causes you to come to arousal. This is an alarm center that registers and monitors for oxygen levels. And the oxygen levels are falling, so the brainstem alerts you to awake, and you awaken just enough to tighten up those muscles, and you go, and you take a breath, and as soon as you do, the oxygen levels rise. That particular alarm in the brainstem goes off. You go right back into sleep, and you go through this all night long. Now, the couple problems with this are the brain likes oxygen. And so if you're doing this all night long with these low oxygen levels, you can actually lose brain cells. You can have brain cells dying. Not a good thing. Secondly, in order to have healthy brain function, you have to go through certain brain cycles or sleep cycles at night. There are several stages of sleep, and people with obstructive sleep apnea don't get through those stages, and thus they don't get the restorative sleep that they need, and they have increasing risk of depression. So if you have obstructive sleep apnea, you need to get that treated. Medications, and I'm not going to go through all the medications, but just be aware there are lots and lots of medications that can contribute to major depression for a lot of reasons. Chronic pain states, I already mentioned how and why that happens. And then brain diseases of various kinds, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Pick's disease, Lewy body disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, all these diseases that attack the brain itself can contribute to depression. So, a question for you. True or false? If someone has depression, it is always a spiritual problem or a problem with their faith in God. True or false? Good for you, a very bright and enlightened audience. Good for you, because you'd be surprised at how many people believe this. If I have depression, it's because I don't have enough faith, and if I had enough faith, I wouldn't have depression. That'd be like saying, if I had enough faith, I wouldn't be going bald. If I had enough faith, I wouldn't have heart disease. If I had enough faith, I wouldn't need glasses, okay? This is a physical disorder that can have a whole host of contributing factors, one of which is a spiritual factor. And it is true that a spiritual factor can contribute to depression, but it's only one factor amongst a long list of other factors that can also contribute to depression. Imagine this. If somebody has pneumonia, along with pneumonia comes fever. Does that then mean everybody with fever has pneumonia? No, you see the point. Okay, psychological and spiritual factors that contribute to depression. Disconnected relationship or broken relationship with God. You don't have God in your life. You don't have God in your life, what happens? Do you have a sense of peace and well-being, or do you have fear and anxiety? Fear and anxiety causes the amygdala to fire constantly. The constantly firing amygdala at a whole cascade of events we just talked about. Unresolved guilt, same process. Unhealthy relationships. We talked about the law of liberty earlier today. We talked about violations of the law of liberty and what happens when liberty is violated. And the cascade of destructive events that occur. Same thing. Forgiveness issues, holding grudges, being resentful, being bitter, fires the amygdala, keeps the whole cascade of events going. Social isolation. We are social beings, and if we're socially isolated, we actually have more anxiety, more fear, more worry, more insecurity, and this can contribute to the whole cascade of events, as well as negative thought processes that can come in there as well. Loss, all kinds of losses, financial loss, reputation loss, job loss, spouse loss or loved one loss of health, loss of limb, any type of loss can contribute to depression. Now, initially it contributes to the normal grieving process, but if the grieving process isn't worked through adequately, then it can result in depression. Unhealthy forms of worship, we talked about those at length today. Unhealthy forms of worship resulting in increasing fear and anxiety and distortions in our own mind can lead to depression. Violations of God's law of love and liberty, we talked about those earlier today, but you can see those can result in increasing worry, fear, and anxiety, which can result in depression. History of abuse. Let me take a moment and talk about history of abuse here and talk about what happens in children who are abused. In order to do that, in fact, let's see if I have that slide coming up. Unremitting stress, real or imagined, and unhealthy. We'll come to the abuse in just a moment. Unhealthy worship. Why does God say worship me? We talked about it earlier today, so we won't talk about it again. Biblical principles, we talked about that, okay, already today once, so we won't talk about it again. And all these unhealthy forms of worship, we talked about most of them today, so I'm not going to go into them again tonight. Okay, law of liberty and law of love. Child abuse, here it is. Child abuse and trauma. Why is child abuse so devastating? And why did Jesus give such a strong warning about abusing children? In order to understand this, we need to understand a few more things about what happens in this brain process. In this part of the brain, the limbic system, not only do you get your fear response, but this is the part of the brain where you get your aggression and rage and hostile emotions coming from as well. This part of your brain up here, where your prefrontal cortex, where you think and reasoning, is the part of your brain where you have self-governance or self-control, one of the fruits of the Spirit. So imagine you're on your way home tonight and somebody cuts you off on the interstate and you get that emotional reaction to be ugly to them, that aggressive emotion. Anybody had that? Feel that? Yeah. That's coming out of your limbic system right here. It's coming out of this limbic system. But if after you get that emotion, that's a temptation, you respond with your prefrontal cortex going, hold on, I'm not like that. I don't want to respond this way. I want to act Christ-like. And you restrain yourself from acting out and you graciously grant them their rudeness. That is your prefrontal cortex, which restrains you and holds you back. Now, I want you to think of disorders where there's an imbalance between prefrontal cortex function and limbic system. Limbic system's functioning at its normal pace. Prefrontal cortex is impaired in some level. A classic example of this type of a process is attention deficit disorder. In the disorder, attention deficit disorder, this part of the brain up here does not have enough chemical called dopamine, and because it doesn't have enough dopamine, then there's impairment of the prefrontal cortex. Core feature, one of the core symptoms of attention deficit people are they have impulse control problems. They have impulses they can't restrain. They act out. They blurt out. They can't govern themselves well because the impulses of the limbic system don't have the governor to keep it in check properly. Let's look at a different disorder, Alzheimer's dementia. As people begin to dement, and Alzheimer's dementia, as they dement, neurons are lost in the prefrontal cortex. Limbic system is still functioning. And what happens here is they lose the ability to govern themselves and they begin acting out violently and sexually in various ways as the dementia progresses. Let's look at another syndrome, alcohol intoxication. You intoxicate somebody with alcohol, you impair the prefrontal cortex. Limbic system is still functioning, and I think you all know the data upon data, the story upon story, the report upon report of people who are intoxicated who lose the ability to govern themselves and act out in various ways. You've seen many movie stars on the news recently who have had this trouble. Different syndrome now, television watching in children. Television watching in children. There's been study after study that shows that increasing amounts of television watching in children result in increasing violence and acting out, aggression, as well as increasing risk of attention deficit disorder. Why? Well, when a child comes into the world, a child is born with hundreds of millions of neurons, brain cells, more at birth than that child has by the time the child is 8 years of age. For the first 7 to 8 years of life, the brain is busy killing off and deleting brain cells. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound like a good thing, does it? But imagine it this way. Michelangelo's block of marble before Michelangelo gets it, and Michelangelo's block of marble when Michelangelo's done with it. When he's done, you have less marble, but you have a masterpiece. The brain comes into the world being prepared to be acted upon by the experience of environment, education, and training. And the neurons which are being used will be retained and strengthened. Those which are not being used will be deleted from the brain. Thus, you've heard reports of young people who were abused and locked away in closets for the first 10 years of their life, and then the social services discovered them and rescued them and tried to speak to them and teach them language. But they could never learn language because the brain cells that respond to language in the temporal regions of the brain were deleted or reassigned because they were not used. This is a process that happens in the brain. And I think I'll pause and because the last one I'm going to give you is child abuse and explain why that happens. So children who watch a lot of TV, what is television function? What is the purpose of television? It is designed, theatrical television now. We're not talking that you are so packed in here one weekend that you can't fit anybody else in the pew, so you set up a closed-circuit TV out there to watch the preacher on the closed-circuit TV in the back room. That is not a problem. The problem is theatrical entertainment. What happens with theatrical entertainment, theatrical television? It's designed to activate your limbic system. It is designed to get you to laugh, to get you to cry, to get you to be afraid, to get you to be aroused, to get you to be aggressive and hostile. It is designed to cause you to have an emotional reaction. That's theatrical television. While at the very same time that is activating these neurons in the limbic system, it is at the very same time turning off the prefrontal cortex, because you don't have to use your imagination. You don't have to reason. You don't have to strategize. The whole prefrontal cortex, everything is supplied for you, and so suspension of the prefrontal cortex occurs, and therefore the limbic system gets stronger and stronger, and the governor gets weaker and weaker, and thus the kids act out violently and so forth the more television they watch. Now, I'm going to explain to you physiologically why that happens, and then we're going to finish up on this section with the childhood abuse question. Remember I told you a moment ago about a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It's like fertilizer for the neurons. When it's there, the neurons get stronger. They branch out, connect. Well, this protein comes from a precursor protein called, interestingly enough and creatively enough, pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor, okay? Pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor, however, is like weed killer for your brain cells. If pro-brain-derived neurotrophic factor hits a brain cell or binds to it, it will kill the brain cell. What determines whether there's pro-BDNF or BDNF is there is an enzyme that will cleave pro-BDNF into brain-derived neurotrophic factor. If that enzyme is present, then the pro-BDNF gets cleaved and the BDNF is there and the neurons get stronger. If that enzyme is not present, then the pro-BDNF comes in and kills the neuron because the enzyme is not there. Now, get this. What determines whether the neuron has the enzyme or doesn't have the enzyme? You're going to love this. The electrical activity of the neuron itself. If the neuron is being fired and being used, it produces the enzyme which cleaves pro-BDNF into BDNF so that circuit gets stronger and grows and recruits more neurons. If the neuron is not being used, then the pro-BDNF comes in and kills the neuron in the neural circuit. Everything depends on the right action of the will. It is by the action of the will that you determine which electrical circuits of your brain, which neurons get fired. And if you fire the neurons, they get stronger. If you don't fire the neurons, they get weaker. Thus, television watching, lots of it activating the limbic system, lots of this enzyme cleaving pro-BDNF into BDNF, thus you get the fertilizer down here strengthening these neurons, increasing their neural net, while at the same time you're not getting it produced up here and these neurons aren't expanding their network, they're not connecting out, they're not becoming more intricate, they're just sitting there kind of not doing anything because they're not being used. Now, I want you to imagine that you in high school took a foreign language class. Now, as you're taking this foreign language class and you're thinking to learn this new word, you're forcing electrical energy down new pathways, this enzyme is there cleaving pro-BDNF into BDNF. It causes the neurons to branch out and connect. New neurons are recruited as you're continuing to study this language, so your vocabulary is increasing. Over time, the neural network continues to expand and your syntax improves. Your ability to enunciate improves as you learn this language more and more. And then you graduate high school and you don't speak this language for 20 years. And now you're going to go take a trip to that country and you want to speak that language. And are you as proficient as you were 20 years ago? No, what happened? You stopped sending electrical energy through those circuits. The enzyme was not there. Pro-BDNF came in and began pruning back that neural network, knocking off these neurons. Now there remains a framework or a skeleton there, but your proficiency and your ability to do this task is significantly undermined because it hasn't been used for such a long time. Now, this reality goes not just to learned information, it actually goes to character development. If you have a bad habit in your life, if you continue to fire the neural circuit, you've got the fertilizer, BDNF, there, making it stronger and stronger and stronger. When you make choices to stop firing the circuit, over time, pro-BDNF will come in and will actually degrade the circuit. And this transformation that we experience through the Holy Spirit working in our life, when truth comes in and we make healthy choices with our life, doesn't just result in character change alone. That character change results in physiologic neural circuitry change of the brain as well. We are incredibly and marvelously made. This is what God is trying to do in our minds, and we have the power to cooperate with Him for this. Okay, so back to the child abuse issue. Why is this such a devastating and destructive thing? I want you to imagine right now that at any moment you believe that someone could come in and beat you severely or rape you. And with that anticipation that it could happen at any second, you've got to go take final exams in college, believing that could happen at any second. Do you think your exam scores could be undermined? Would it affect your exam scores? And you have a fully developed prefrontal cortex. What about a child growing up in a home whose prefrontal cortex isn't developed yet, and they're in a home that any moment daddy can come in and beat them or molest them? Their amygdala, their anxiety centers are constantly firing. Prefrontal cortex up here is frozen in fear and is not working. And so these kids grow up in a situation where they're not only getting bad software, bad teaching, bad relationships, bad psychology, they're actually getting bad hardware. And they come into adulthood with overstimulated limbic systems and impaired prefrontal cortex. And so they're moody, they're irrational, they're unreasonable. It's hard for them to think clearly, hard for them to process. They have very poor impulse control. They act out a lot. If you know somebody like this, don't be distraught. Don't be hopeless. Even though this is the reality of the situation, the brain is pliable. The brain is healable. God is gracious. And even though that's the situation, through God's grace, through the application of the truth, this whole process can be resolved and remedied, and the prefrontal cortex can be developed, Christ-like character being worked in. But it is a painful and difficult process that needs often professional help to have that occur. But I don't want somebody, if you know a family member or somebody like that, I don't want you to be discouraged just because of what I described. It is a devastating and difficult thing, but it's not without hope. Unresolved guilt and unforgiveness activates the amygdala, the alarm center, causing that whole cascade of destructive events we already talked about. Nutritional factors. Omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3 fatty acids are a nutrient that your brain and body require but cannot make it. If you don't get it in the foods you eat, you don't have it. This nutrient does several good things for you. It raises your good cholesterol, lowers your bad cholesterol, helps protect against ischemic heart attacks and strokes. But each individual brain cell, the actual building blocks, the building components that construct the membrane of each individual brain cell are omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. Your body cannot make omega-3s, so if you don't get them in the food you eat, then your brain cells don't have them, and they use omega-6s only, but that causes the brain cells to become more rigid and stiff, less elastic and less pliable. They don't signal as well, and studies show if you're deficient in omega-3s, you have higher rates of depression and bipolar disorder, the mood disorders. Omega-3s come from, if you want a vegetarian source, flax seed and black walnuts, not regular walnuts, and cold water fish caught in the wild, such as salmon or mackerel, not shellfish and freshwater fish. The fish don't actually make it. They get it from plant sources in the ocean. I generally have my patients take 2,000 to 3,000 milligram supplements every day and get them over the counter at Walmart. Folate. Vitamin B6, vitamin B12, homocysteine, tryptophan. Tryptophan is a precursor to serotonin. If you're on a tryptophan-deficient diet, then you will have increasing rates of depression. But hardly anybody is actually on a tryptophan-deficient diet. It's a very common amino acid that's in most foods and proteins. You actually have to work to avoid tryptophan, but you can, if you're tryptophan-deficient, become depressed. Okay, omega-3 fatty acids, already mentioned. Folate, B6, B12, and the homocysteine connection. You don't have to really memorize all this or look at all this even. It's complex. I'll tell you what it means in a moment. But homocysteine, in your body, all the cellular functions of your body, inside the cells, they have little organelles. They have lots of chemical reactions going on all day long. And one of the chemical reactions, they require a chemical group called a methyl group. And there's an amino acid that you get in the food you eat called methionine. It donates the methyl group. And when it does, it gives off a byproduct called homocysteine. Homocysteine, I want you to imagine dragging a piece of barbed wire through a soft rubber hose. If you took a piece of barbed wire and drug it through a soft rubber hose, what would happen? It would nick up and tear up the inside of the hose, right? That's what homocysteine does throughout the blood vessels of your body. It goes around nicking up the blood vessels, the endothelial linings of the blood vessels in your body. And that happens in the plate that's coming behind it to try and patch up that, and causes little tiny coagulation to occur, blocking up microvascular insults, causing microvascular strokes and increased risk of heart attacks. Additionally, the homocysteine is actually damaging to the brain cells as well, and we can have an independent risk factor for both ischemic heart attacks, strokes, and depression. The reason I tell you all that is because the body has two pathways to get rid of homocysteine. You don't have to remember the pathways, but one of the pathways is dependent on B6 and folate. B12 and folate. The other pathway is dependent on B6. If you don't have B6 and if you don't have B12 and folate, then your body cannot get rid of homocysteine. Homocysteine levels rise in the body, and that's a bad thing. Problems with elevated homocysteine levels injures brain cells, impairs cellular metabolism, impairs DNA synthesis and repair if homocysteine levels are high, increases toxic stress on brain cells, potential impact on inflammatory pathways like inflammation and things like that. Okay, B12 levels in vegetarians. 78% of vegans have low B12 levels. 24% of lacto-ovo-vegetarians were low in B12. 0% of omnivores were low in B12. If you're a vegetarian of either kind, you need to take a B12 supplement. Elevated homocysteine levels in vegetarians. 53% of vegans have elevated homocysteine levels. 29% of lacto-ovo-vegetarians have elevated homocysteine levels. 5% of omnivores have elevated homocysteine levels. So if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, you probably want to get on a B12, B6, folic acid supplement. I take one every day. I actually had my homocysteine levels checked. You can go to your doctor and say, "Can you check my homocysteine level, please?" They can do it. It's an easy blood test. And my homocysteine levels, I'm a vegetarian, were elevated. I've been on a B12 and folic acid supplement for 10 years at least now. Other factors, 30 to 40% of intrinsic, this is the amount of B12 in foods, is destroyed by microwave cooking. You cook by microwave, 30 to 40% of B12 is destroyed. 50% of natural folates are destroyed with conventional cooking, and a higher than 50% is destroyed with microwave cooking. So even if you're eating your green leafy vegetables, if you're cooking them in these ways, you're destroying these vitamins and nutrients. B12 requires a low pH in your gut in order for B12 to be absorbed. If you're on a proton pump inhibitor, which are things like Prilosec, Nexium, Prevacid, those types of medicines, they raise the pH in the gut and make it difficult for B12 to be absorbed. Hormone replacement therapy. Hormone replacement therapy, estrogen replacement in women actually decreases homocysteine levels. So if you're on hormone replacement therapy, that's a good thing, lowering homocysteine levels. Low folates were more common in depressed patients, and depressed patients with low folates have poorer outcomes than people with normal folic acid levels, and folate supplementation improves response to treatment. Now, why the apparent increase in depression and mental illnesses at this time in history? Well, the Bible says at the end of time, men will run to and fro, their hearts failing them for fear. And as fear goes up, amygdala fires, that whole cascade of negative events occur. So the more fear, the more likely this is to happen. We have more television watching, and you saw the destructive things that television does. It's overstimulating amygdala and decreasing prefrontal cortex. Increased alcohol, illegal drugs, and caffeine and tobacco. But primarily, we have much more illegal drugs. Prior to the 20th century, they had basically alcohol, caffeine, and tobacco. Now we have all the designer drugs as well as cocaine, crystal meth, and all these other things. So many more damaging chemicals as well. As all the pesticides and all the pollutants we have in society, they're damaging to the brain. Man-made chemicals and pollutants, evolutionary theory and humanism, which undermines a belief in God, increasing fear and causing unhealthy relationships and unhealthy interactions with others so we don't resolve our guilt and so forth in proper ways. Change in diet, fast food and microwaving cooking, killing many of the nutrients that we just talked about that your brain and body needs. Dissolution of the family and community networks so people feel more isolated and alone. And cultural changes which put self at the center, there's less altruism and more entitlement mentality contributing to these factors as well. Treatment options and strategies, and we're just about done. This is preventative measures, things that you can do to help prevent or help yourself stay healthy, both physically and in your brain. Omega-3 fatty acid supplementation in your diet, 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day. Vitamin C, I didn't talk about vitamin C, but it is an antioxidant. It is water-soluble, so it resides inside the cytoplasm or the fluid inside your cells, scavenging up free radicals and protecting your brain cells, where the omega-3s and vitamin E will reside in the membranes of the brain cells, scavenging up free radicals and protecting them on that level. Folates and B12, we talked about good stress management. So you handle your stress, you process through things, you don't ignore them, you work through them, talk through your problems, so you keep your amygdala firing low. Exercise on a regular basis, healthy spirituality, so you believe the truth about God. You don't have lies about God in your head, and you practice healthy principles in the way you deal with others and healthy relationships. Avoid alcohol, drugs, tobacco, caffeine. Regular sleep, we talked about that. Sunshine, which is an important factor as well. Guard the avenues to the mind so you're protective of the kind of things you read, watch, and the information coming in. And then beneficence, living in loving service for others. These are the preventative measures you can do. Specific treatment strategies, we want to first diagnose the problem, make sure they're depressed, and then when they're depressed, we want to try and find out what are the contributing factors to this particular person's depression, and then we want to target the specific contributing factors to that patient and have an intervention designed to treat that patient's specific problems. Questions?
How much vitamin B12 you have to take to lower the homocysteine level?
Yeah, you want to take B12 in conjunction with the other vitamins as well. And boy, that's an over-the-counter supplement would be fine. And I can't remember. I think it's 500 micrograms a day would be fine. I actually take more than that. The prescription ones are actually more than that, but 500 micrograms a day would be sufficient. I'm sure.
Does it affect the blood pressure?
No.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious about the caffeine affecting us as far as depression is concerned.
All right. How caffeine works. Every cell of your body uses an energy chemical, if you remember your biology 101, called ATP. ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Everybody remember hearing about that? Adenosine tri means three. It's adenosine molecule with three phosphates, adenosine triphosphate. As it gives off a phosphate, it gives up energy to drive the energy for all the things we do all day long. So it gives up a phosphate, becomes adenosine diphosphate. Di means two. And then it gives up another phosphate, giving off more energy, adenosine monophosphate, one. And it gives off as the last adenosine, becomes plain old depleted adenosine, no more energy to give. As we go through the day, our adenosine levels begin to rise. As the adenosine levels begin to rise, we have receptors in our brain that register the rising adenosine levels, and that causes us to feel tired and fatigued. So we want to go to sleep and rest where the adenosine is repackaged into ATP, and we can wake up feeling refreshed and energetic. How does caffeine work? Caffeine does a couple of things. One, it binds to the adenosine receptors in the brain, blocking the ability of the adenosine to register. So the adenosine levels are rising, but we don't register it, so we get the illusion that we have energy when we don't. So we continue to function longer, depleting further and further our energy stores. The second thing caffeine does is it, which causes a sense of brain activation, which can activate the sympathetic nervous system and the amygdala. At the same time, it binds to receptors in your blood vessels, causing constriction of the blood vessels, decreasing blood flow into the brain, so we have less glucose and oxygen coming to the brain. At the same time, we get the illusion that we need to be more active, so brain activity is picking up. And at the same time that we're firing amygdala, and sometimes the people who drink caffeine will have heart racing going on and so forth. So this problem results, if you drink lots of caffeine, that you actually deplete vital energy stores. Now what happens if you're a big caffeine drinker, and we're not talking one caffeinated beverage a day, we're talking substantial amounts of caffeine, but I have patients that drink two pots of coffee a day, 3 liters of Coca-Cola a day. Okay, this is substantial amounts. If they were to stop suddenly, what would happen is that the blood vessels that were used to being constricted would not have the caffeine and will dilate significantly, and they will get pounding headaches that will last several days. And so I don't have my patients stop suddenly. I have them taper over a couple of weeks to avoid those pounding headaches. The other thing that happens when you use significant amounts of caffeine and you stop is because you've had this illusion of not being tired. You have all this depleted adenosine lying around. The first thing your brain and body wants to do is they want to replenish your ATP stores. So it takes a couple of weeks for your body to clear and regenerate all this ATP before you start feeling energetic again. So after stopping caffeine, you have a week or two where you feel tired and you feel lethargic and you don't have any energy. And people then go, well, I just can't function without my caffeine after 2 days, and they start right back on it. If they would give themselves 2 to 3 weeks, then they would actually end up with more energy and more alert than they were when they're drinking their caffeine. But that's how caffeine works and contributes to a factor in depression. Other questions?
Before I've been Christian, I went to sleep all the time, and to tell you the truth, I tried to kill myself too many times. But right now, once a year, I feel too tired. I feel sleepy. When I got a big problem, I want to sleep. If I lost my job, I don't look for another job, so I take a long time. So I got to go to the doctor
Yeah, I would recommend.
To tell you the truth, I don't trust doctors.
Yeah. No, I would recommend if you're having symptoms that are serious enough to impair your function that you actually do see a professional, see a physician. First, have the physician do a good physical exam to make sure there's no physical contributing factors. You say this happens once a year. I would be interested to know what time of year this occurs. If this happens only in the wintertime, this might actually be seasonal affective disorder, and it might be treated with something as simple as getting one of those 10,000 lux lights and getting up and sitting in front of it before dawn each morning for 15 to 30 minutes. Not staring at it. You can just have to be within a couple of feet of it. You can be reading a paper or whatever you want, as long as the light can shine into your eyes. And you can have, and that could be, if it's happening only in the winter every year, that could be a significant factor, and you might want to try that. But certainly, if the primary care physician doesn't find anything, then you probably want to see a psychiatrist and get evaluated for potential treatment for depression.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And one more question in the back.
Really quickly, can you talk about anxiety and the reasons for panic attacks or how they come on?
Yeah. Were you here this morning? We talked about panic? Okay. Yeah, I talked about panic this morning. I gave an example in one of our talks about a lady who had panic. Panic is very amenable to psychotherapies because panic almost always has as its root some cognitive distortion of the prefrontal cortex, some idea, some process that's going on in our brains that impair our that contribute to panic. I gave the example this morning. Imagine that you're swimming and you're racing your sibling underwater, who can swim the farthest underwater, and you get to that point where you know you have to come up. And as you start up, somebody reaches in and holds your head down underwater. What does that feel like? It feels like panic. Sometimes we can find ourselves in situations in life in which we feel like we've got so many problems, so many responsibilities, so many burdens, so many bills coming down on us at once that we can't handle it all. People actually say things like, I just can't get my head above water. And even though it's not real water, it's psychological water, the sensation that they're drowning on all their problems will cause the same reaction of panic to start. And so in that situation, the person would need to evaluate and reorganize their situation to get their head above water. The example I gave this morning is when they were in a domineering relationship and their own individuality was being stifled or suffocated in this controlling, dominating relationship, and they felt like they were suffocating by the control of another person. They have to extricate themselves from that situation. Sometimes people have panic as a consequence of death anxiety. They had a near-death experience, and now they've come face-to-face with their own mortality, and they begin having panic attacks associated with that. So panic attacks are most of the time related to some psychological factor that can usually be amenable to psychotherapy. Occasionally, they're due to some physiologic factor, but usually that's not the case. Oh, one more question. Okay.
My question is just for clarification. When God asks us to worship Him, we know we have the Trinity, God Father, God Son, and the Holy Spirit. When Jesus Christ was here on earth, He always directed us to worship His Father. So sometimes I have a hard time like trying to explain to people that we should only worship God. And then at the same time, Jesus Christ directs us to the Father, but we should also worship Jesus as we know that he was also God. So it's like God also asks us, do not worship or try to view me on any way, because we cannot really have a form of him. But when Jesus Christ was here on earth with us, then we got a form of him also. And it gets a little confusing to me.
What was your question?
My question is like, God says do not worship any, let's say, at idols or anything. But when we have Jesus Christ, who is God the Son, we already have a form too.
I'm still not following your question. What's your question?
So my question is, shall we worship only the Father and be careful when we worship Jesus Christ as he is the priest on heaven for us? It gets a little confusing to me that.
And when it says, thou shalt know the gods before me, where do you get that from?
What?
The statement, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Where does that come from?
Well, it is in the Bible.
But where in the Bible specifically?
In the Ten Commandments.
In the Ten Commandments. Uh-huh. And who was it that wrote the Ten Commandments with their finger?
God himself.
Which member of the Godhead?
Well, through Moses.
Which member, God the Father, God the Son, or God the Holy Spirit, wrote the Ten Commandments?
Well, I guess it's God the Father.
No, it was Christ. Paul says in Corinthians that the rock which led the children of Israel through the desert and gave them the water was Jesus Christ. He was the member of the Godhead who interfaced with humanity at all levels, and he was the one who met him at Sinai and wrote the statement, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And then in the New Testament, when they were talking with the Jews, Christ said to them, Abraham longed to see my day, and he did. And they said, how can you, who are not even 50 years of age, see Abraham? And he said, before Abraham was, I am. Christ is the great I am. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, it says, for unto us a child is born. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. Who's the counselor? The Holy Spirit. Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. When you worship Jesus, you are worshiping God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. Thank you guys very much.